This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
They want the dissolution of security service. They want to put all officials on trials.
That's reporter Naba Mohadin in Khartoum covering the rapidly changing situation there. Details next. Also, aid agencies say the situation in Tripoli continues to deteriorate as the death toll rose to 147 from fighting for control of Libya's capital. And Ivanka Trump was in Ethiopia's capital for a summit on African women's economic inclusion and empowerment. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Protesters in Khartoum today continue their sit-in near the Sudan military headquarters despite a brief attempt by soldiers to clear them away. Protesters say they are not leaving until the military, which removed President Omar al-Bashir last week, agrees to let a civilian government immediately take office. One point of contention for the protesters is the fate of Sali Ghosh, the former head of the National Intelligence and Security Service. He resigned Saturday, but many protesters say that he should be arrested for his role in Bashir's repressive government. Reporter Naba Mohadin is in Khartoum and has been covering the rapidly changing situation there. She tells VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson that for a few days after Bashir was forced out, protesters began to become divided. That has changed, however.
Protesters were divided into two. People say that there is no need for a sit-in anymore, and some people said, no, we have to sit-in because we don't trust military. And that was since Thursday, after the announcement of the new man, Abdurrahman Burhan. But when yesterday the spokesman of the military council announced the acceptance of resignation of Mr. Salah Ghosh, people were very angry, and the sit-in was very strong again, and saying that they want the dissolution of security service. They want to put all officials on trials, and they even suspect the coup. They said that we didn't see anyone on trial, we didn't see anyone who was in jail. So right now they are seeking for proofs from military council, or they will continue in the sit-in.
What are some of the political developments other than having Mr. Salah Ghosh resign? The government, the new ruling government, has arrested members of Mr. Bashir's cabinet. Gil, what's going on with that?
The thing is, they announced that yesterday, and they said that they will put them on trials. But as I told you, some protesters say that even when al-Bashir regime came to power, they gave same promises. So unless they see them on trials, they will not believe that. And in another hand, in political scene, army today, the military council, transitional council today, announced that they will restrict the army chief staff. And they appointed a new man called Hashim Abdul Muntalab as the head of the as the chief of the army staff. And this guy was appointed by al-Bashir himself in February, 2 months ago. So people right now are really frustrated because they think most of the members in the council, they are Islamic somehow, or they are connected to al-Bashir somehow. So SPA, Sudanese Professional Association, calling people to protest and sit in till they have real proofs, and they think that the council is responding in very playful way and not real way. And they also announced that they arrested officials, and the only proof that this thing might happen is the NCP, National Congress Party, the ruling party, al-Bashir party, has issued a press release calling the military council to release the officials. they arrest in the first days of the coup.
That was Naba Mohideen in Khartoum speaking with my colleague Kate Brown Dawson. Aid agencies say the situation in Tripoli continues to deteriorate as the death toll rose to 147 from fighting for control of Libya's capital. Forces loyal to military strongman Khalifa Haftar began assaulting Tripoli on April 4th, displacing more than 18,000 people and trapping migrants seeking to get to Europe. The battle has dashed hopes of a negotiated peace to reunite the country and hold national elections. Before the fighting broke out, a meeting for national reconciliation had been planned for yesterday. Haftar's forces have been mostly stopped in their advance, about 11 kilometers from the center of Tripoli. Aid agencies have said the fighting could drag on for weeks, with medical and food supplies running short. Cameroon authorities have detained 30 Nigerians who crossed the border Saturday on suspicion of links to Boko Haram Islamist militants. Police say the group of mainly women and children did not have permission to cross the border and did not have identification cards and failed to answer the questions. As Moki Edwin Kinzaka reports from Maroua, Cameroon.
Cameroon security forces say they traced a bus transporting the detained suspects as it illegally crossed the border Saturday from Gamborungala, a former stronghold of Boko Haram militants in Nigeria. Chetima Mala Abba is the highest-ranking police officer in Cameroon's far north region, which borders with Nigeria. He says when stopped by police, the 30 Nigerians, mainly women and children, raised further suspicions.
Ce monsieur a chargé depuis Gambarou, dans la zone rouge.
He says they have been detained for not being able to present any identification papers, not being able to give the names of the people they claim they want to visit in Cameroon, and for entering the country from a Boko Haram alert zone without obtaining the necessary clearance. Abba gave no further evidence for the Nigerians' alleged links to Boko Haram, but police say they take such suspicious crossings from Nigeria very seriously. Boko Haram militants, they say, have in the past disguised as commuters, merchants, or even clerics to launch attacks in Cameroon. And the group has been known to use female suicide bombers. Police in Maroua say they are investigating the Nigerians' identities and reasons for coming to Cameroon. When seen by a reporter, the detained 30 Nigerians, some in burqas, looked tired but in good health. Nigeria authorities had no immediate reaction to the detentions. The governor of the far north region, Midji Yawa Bakari, says Boko Haram attacks have diminished in recent months due to increased security measures. But he warned Boko Haram looks for opportunities to infiltrate when many people are traveling across the border for religious or national holidays.
Nous sommes à l'aube de la fête du 1er mai, la fête du 20 mai.
Bakari says he ordered the police and military to intensify checks around the border zone as Cameroon prepares for national and religious events. During the Muslim holy month of Ramadan that begins on May 5, International Labor Day on May 1, and National Day on May 20, Boko Haram tries to infiltrate and kill people as they gather around mosques and markets, he says. Bakari credits also efforts by the multinational joint task force of the Lake Chad Basin Commission, made up of troops from Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria, for improved security. Boko Haram extended its attacks from inside Nigeria to Cameroon 6 years ago, after Cameroon's troops began assisting the Nigerian military in fighting the extremists. Cameroon authorities say more than 1,500 Cameroonians have been killed in the attacks. Nigerian and regional troops have taken back most of the territory that Boko Haram once controlled, but the Islamist terrorists are still able to launch frequent attacks. The United Nations says Boko Haram killed 88 people in Nigeria in March, compared to a total of 107 deaths for all of 2018, and that a new pattern of targeting displaced people was emerging. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Marwa, Northern Cameroon.
You're listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Protesters in Khartoum today continue their sit-in near the Sudan military headquarters, despite a brief attempt by soldiers to clear them away. Aid agencies say the situation in Tripoli continues to deteriorate as the death toll rose to 147 from fighting for control of Libya's capital. And Cameroon authorities have detained 30 Nigerians who crossed the border Saturday on suspicion of links to Boko Haram militants. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Ivanka Trump met with religious leaders today at Holy Trinity Cathedral, an Ethiopian Orthodox church. The U.S. president's daughter laid a wreath at the cathedral to honor the victims of last month's Ethiopian Airlines crash that killed all 157 people on board. Ivanka Trump arrived in Ethiopia's capital yesterday for a summit on Africa's women's economic inclusion and empowerment. A senior advisor to her father, she also visited a coffee shop and textile company. She is in the East African country to promote a $50 million initiative enacted by her father in February that is aimed at encouraging women's employment in developing countries.
Fundamentally, we believe that investing in women is smart development policy and it's smart business. It's also in our security interests because women, when they're empowered, foster peace and stability.
The Women's Global Development and Prosperity Initiative says it hopes to reach 50 million women by 2025 through the work of the United States government and its partners.
Women have disproportionately high barriers to thriving both in the workplace and as entrepreneurs, and that's why we launched the first ever all of U.S. government initiative called WGDP, which seeks to accomplish three goals. The first pillar is allowing women to prosper in the workplace, and that's technical assistance, mentorship, vocational education. The second is promoting women entrepreneurs like yourself. And the third pillar is about changing laws that prohibit women's full and free participation in their local economies.
Ivanka Trump also met with Ethiopian President Sahle Work Zewde and Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed before going on to Ivory Coast, where she will attend a meeting on economic opportunities for women in West Africa. She's also scheduled to make an appearance at a World Bank Policy Summit. Zimbabwe's government has further committed to compensate thousands of white farmers who were displaced during the controversial 2000 violent land invasions. Reporter Kuzai Zinawashi has more.
Ben Gilpin is the president of the Commercial Farmers Union, which has been working with the government to finalize and start rolling out compensations.
We've been assisting with the admin on getting people registered, and that is already at quite an advanced stage. We expect that this process of application will close on the 17th before independence. Many farmers, particularly the elderly, have had no livelihood really since they stopped farming. You've got many people in their 70s and life has been tough. So the interim relief is something that we welcome. It's a very positive move, although in terms of the global amount, it's actually a drop in the ocean.
Permanent Secretary in the Ministry of Information, Nick Mangwana, has said the government is only compensating for the improvements that were done on the farms and not necessarily paying for the land. Rashid Mukundu is a political analyst who applauds the government's plan.
I think it's a good move by the government of President Emmerson Mnangagwa to compensate white farmers and close this chapter of conflict in Zimbabwe. I think it's also important to emphasize the message that Zimbabwe must not necessarily burden itself with compensation beyond its capacity, meaning that this program must be long-term within the resources that are available, balancing with other needs. There must be an acceptable mechanism by both parties.
Ben Frith is a prominent white Zimbabwean farmer who was a victim of the land invasion. He says the 53 million RTGS dollars, which is equivalent to about 12 million US dollars, is a publicity move.
We've got a situation where government has put forward 53 million RTGS dollars, which are worth at this stage about a quarter of a US dollar. So it's kind of about 10 million US dollars to try and compensate 7,000 title deeds. What it seems to me to be is a propaganda exercise to make it look as though the government is coming back to rule of law, is starting to do things correctly.
Frith says a better offer on the value of the farms will be more appropriate. The Minister of Finance has said they are still assessing the value of developments made on the farms. Mukundu says while land was taken on the pretext that it belonged to native Zimbabweans and no payments were made, it should be noted that some farms were bought post-independence. Some farms belonged to companies and some were protected through bilateral agreements between Zimbabwe and foreign nations. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Uganda's government and refugee agencies have started planting trees in an effort to restore degraded forests in refugee host communities. The program comes after warnings from some environmentalists that indiscriminate tree cutting in refugee host areas could soon lead to prolonged drought and food insecurity. It is estimated each refugee cuts about 20 trees annually. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
To satisfy their immediate needs for shelter, cooking, agriculture and income generation, many refugees settling in Uganda cut trees for construction and fuel. The result is expanding deforestation around refugee settlements. Paul Adiang is a South Sudan refugee in Bidibidi settlement.
I think they want to cook with that firewood, and others they want to burn the charcoal, because through that burning of charcoal you can get something like money from it. That is why they are cutting our trees.
As more refugees enter Uganda, there is fear the forest covering refugee host areas might be gone in a few years. And environmentalists warn that could contribute to increasing drought and food insecurity. Gerald Menya is the Commissioner for Refugees in the Office of the Prime Minister.
A study has been conducted and it has been discovered that where refugees are in the first 2 years, loss of vegetation cover is close to 58%, meaning that maybe within 5 years or 10 years, there will be no forest wherever these refugees are.
Uganda's National Environment Management Authority, NEMA, is pushing the government to include reforestation in its refugee response programs. Tom Okrut is the executive director, NEMA.
Whoever is managing the refugee camps, particularly the Prime Minister's office and more specifically UNHCR, they must include environmental aspects in their management of the refugee camps. And the most important thing is to really to reinstate the stock of trees three times than that is cut by the refugees.
Titus Jogo is the Adjumani District Refugee Desk Officer. He says to foster reforestation, each refugee is given a number of trees to plant along with relief items.
So as we give you jerry cans, as we give you plastic sheetings, as we give you food to go and settle, we give you 10 plants. And these are fruit trees for you to go and grow, not plant. Because at times when we say they go and plant, they will plant and abandon. But you plant and make sure it grows.
Joel Boutreau is the country representative of the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR. His agency is joining the effort.
Each refugee cuts 20 trees a year, which is slightly less, in fact, than what a typical Ugandan would cut, because they have less resources. So our ambition is to replant, very simplistically in a way, it's a goal, 20 million trees, because you have more or less 1 million refugees in settlements. So multiply by 20 trees, 20 million trees.
The depletion of the trees not only harms the vegetation cover, but also causes conflict between the host communities and refugees over wood fuel scarcity. Priya Gujadra is the Deputy Country Representative, Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO. She says tree planting programs can help reduce the conflict.
Helping them plant trees around their plots of land, it helps them demarcate their land, reduces conflict in the long run with the host communities. No, this is my boundary. No, the boundary is somewhere else. It also helps reduce some of the pressure off of the natural forest, because they use these relatively quick-growing species for their fuel wood.
The Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that each refugee uses 2.5 kilograms of wood fuel a day, which means that 347,000 tons of wood is burned every year. Environment authorities have also earmarked endangered tree species like the shea-nut tree with red paint, meaning they cannot be cut. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello Africa, this is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5 and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has made headlines for pushing through unprecedented reforms. But many challenges lie ahead in creating a national consensus. Discussing Ethiopia's future on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.